most of us were in the States, a small team, and no outside funding. These constraints forced us to keep the product simple. These days, we have more resources and people, but we still force constraints. We make sure to have only one or two people working on a product at a time, and we always keep features to a minimum. Boxing ourselves in this way prevents us from creating bloated products. So before you sing the not enough blues, see how far you can get with what you have. Build half a product, not a half-assed product. You can turn a bunch of great ideas into a crappy product real fast by trying to do them all at once. You just can't do everything you want to do and do it well. You have limited time, resources, ability, and focus. It's hard enough to do one thing right, trying to do 10 things well at the same time. Forget about it. So sacrifice some of your darlings for the greater good. Cut your ambition in half. You're better off with a kick-ass half than a half-assed whole. Most of your great ideas won't seem all that great once you get some perspective anyway. And if they truly are that fantastic, you can always do them later. Lots of things get better as they get shorter. Directors cut good scenes to make a great movie. Musicians drop good tracks to make a great album. Writers eliminate good pages to make a great book. We cut this book in half between the next to last and final drafts, from 57,000 words to about 27,000 words. Trust us, it's better for it. So start chopping. Getting to great starts by cutting out stuff that's merely good. Start at the epicenter. When you start anything new, there are forces pulling you in a variety of directions. There's the stuff you could do, the stuff you want to do, and the stuff you have to do. The stuff you have to do is where you should begin. Start at the epicenter. For example, if you're opening a hot dog stand, you could worry about the condiments, the cart, the name, the decoration. But the first thing you should worry about is the hot dog. The hot dogs are the epicenter. Everything else is secondary. The way to find the epicenter is to ask yourself this question. If I took this away, would what I'm selling still exist? A hot dog stand isn't a hot dog stand without the hot dogs. You can take away the onions, the relish, the mustard, etc. Some people may not like your toppings-less dogs, but you'd still have a hot dog stand. But you simply cannot have a hot dog stand without any hot dogs. So figure out your epicenter. Which part of your equation can't be removed? If you can continue to get by without this thing or that thing, then those things aren't the epicenter. When you find it, you'll know. Then focus all your energy on making it the best it can be. Everything else you do depends on that foundation. Ignore the details early on. Architects don't worry about which tiles go in the shower or which brand of dishwasher to install in the kitchen until after the floor plan is finalized. They know it's better to decide these details later. You need to approach your idea the same way. Details make the difference. But getting infatuated with the details too early leads to disagreement, meetings, and delays. You get lost in things that don't really matter. You waste time on decisions that are going to change anyway. So ignore the details. For a while. Nail the basics first and worry about the specifics later. When we start designing something, we sketch out ideas with a big, thick Sharpie marker instead of a ballpoint pen. Why? Pen points are too fine. They're too high resolution. They encourage you to worry about things that you shouldn't worry about yet, like perfecting the shading or whether to use a dotted or dashed line. You end up focusing on things that should still be out of focus. A Sharpie makes it impossible to drill down that deep. You can only draw shapes, lines, and boxes. That's good. The big picture is all you should be worrying about in the beginning. Walt Stanchfield, famed drawing instructor for Walt Disney Studios, used to encourage animators to forget the detail at first. The reason? Detail just doesn't buy you anything in the early stages. Besides, you often can't recognize the details that matter most until after you start building. That's when you see what needs more attention. You feel what's missing. And that's when you need to pay attention, not sooner. Making the call is making progress. When you put off decisions, they pile up. And piles end up ignored, dealt with in haste, or thrown out. As a result, the individual problems in those piles stay unresolved. Whenever you can, swap "let's think about it" for "let's decide on it." Commit to making decisions. Don't wait for the perfect solution. Decide and move forward. You want to get into the rhythm of making choices. When you get in that flow of making decision after decision, you build momentum and boost morale. Decisions are progress. Each one you make is a brick in your foundation. You can't build on top of "we'll decide later," but you can build on top of "done." The problem comes when you postpone decisions in the hope that a perfect answer will come to you later. It won't. You're as likely to make a great call today as you are tomorrow. An example from our world. For a long time, we avoided creating an affiliate program for our products because the perfect solution seemed way too complicated. We'd have to automate payments, mail out checks, figure out foreign tax laws for overseas affiliates, etc. The breakthrough came when we asked, "What can we easily do right now that's good enough?" The answer? Pay affiliates in credit instead of cash. So that's what we did. We stuck with that approach for a while and then eventually implemented a system that pays cash. And that's a big part of this. You don't have to live with a decision forever. If you make a mistake, you can correct it later. It doesn't matter how much you plan, you'll still get some stuff wrong anyway. Don't make things worse by overanalyzing and delaying before you even get going. Long projects zap morale. The longer it takes to develop, the less likely it is to launch. Make the call, make progress, and get something out now, while you've got the motivation and momentum to do so. Be a curator. You don't make a great museum by putting all the art in the world into a single room. That's a warehouse. What makes a museum great is the stuff that's not on the walls. Someone says no. A curator is involved, making conscious decisions about what should stay and what should go. There's an editing process. There's a lot more stuff off the walls than on the walls. The best is a subset of all the possibilities. It's the stuff you leave out that matters. So constantly look for things to remove, simplify, and streamline. Be a curator. Stick to what's truly essential. Pare things down until you're left with only the most important stuff. Then do it again. You can always add stuff back in later if you need to. Zingerman's is one of America's best-known delis. And it's got that way because its owners think of themselves as curators. They're not just filling their shelves. They're curating them. There's a reason for every olive oil the team at Zingerman sells. They believe each one is great. Usually, they've known the supplier for years. They've visited and picked olives with them. That's why they can vouch for each oil's authentic, full-bodied flavor. For example, look how the owner of Zingerman's describes Passolivo olive oil on the company website. "I tasted this oil for the first time years ago, on a random recommendation and sample. There are plenty of oils that come in nice bottles with very endearing stories to tell. This was no exception. But most simply aren't that great. By contrast, Passolivo got my attention as soon as I tasted it. It's powerful, full, and fruity. Everything I like in an oil without any drawbacks. It still stands as one of America's best oils, on par with the great rustic oils of Tuscany. Strongly recommended." The owner actually tried the oil and chooses to carry it based on its taste. It's not about packaging, marketing, or price. It's about quality. He tried it and knew his store had to carry it. That's the approach you should take too. Throw less at the problem. Watch Chef Gordon Ramsay's Kitchen Nightmares and you'll see a pattern. The menus at failing restaurants offer too many dishes. The owners think making every dish under the sun will broaden the appeal of the restaurant. Instead, it makes for crappy food and creates inventory headaches. That's why Ramsay's first step is nearly always to trim the menu, usually from 30-plus dishes to around 10. Think about that. Improving the current menu doesn't come first. Trimming it down comes first. Then he polishes what's left. When things aren't working, the natural inclination is to throw more at the problem. More people, time, and money. All that ends up doing is making the problem bigger. The right way to go is the opposite direction. Cut back. So do less. Your project won't suffer nearly as much as you fear. In fact, there's a good chance it'll end up even better. You'll be forced to make tough calls and sort out what truly matters. If you start pushing back deadlines and increasing your budget, you'll never stop. Focus on what won't change. A lot of companies focus on the next big thing. They latch on to what's hot and new. They follow the latest trends in technology. That's a fool's path. You start focusing on fashion instead of substance. You start paying attention to things that are constantly changing instead of things that last. The core of your business should be built around things that won't change. Things that people are going to want today and 10 years from now. Those are the things you should invest in. Amazon.com focuses on fast or free shipping, great selection, friendly return policies, and affordable prices. These things will always be in high demand. Japanese automakers also focus on core principles that don't change: reliability, affordability, and practicality. People wanted those things 30 years ago, they want them today, and they'll want them 30 years from now. For 37 Signals, things like speed, simplicity, ease of use, and clarity are our focus. Those are timeless desires. People aren't going to wake up in 10 years and say, "Man, I wish software was harder to use." They won't say, "I wish this application was slower." Remember, fashion fades away. When you focus on permanent features, you're in bed with things that never go out of style. Tone is in your fingers. Guitar gurus say, tone is in your fingers. You can buy the same guitar, effects pedals, and amplifier that Eddie Van Halen uses, but when you play that rig, it's still going to sound like you. Likewise, Eddie could plug into a crappy Strat pig-nose setup at a pawn shop, and you'd still be able to recognize that it's Eddie Van Halen playing. Fancy gear can help, but the truth is, your tone comes from you. It's tempting for people to obsess over tools instead of what they're going to do with those tools. You know the type. Designers who use an avalanche of funky typefaces and fancy Photoshop filters, but don't have anything to say. Amateur photographers who want to debate film versus digital endlessly, instead of focusing on what actually makes a photograph great. Many amateur golfers think they need expensive clubs, but it's the swing that matters, not the club. Give Tiger Woods a set of cheap clubs, and he'll still destroy you. People use equipment as a crutch. They don't want to put in the hours on the driving range, so they spend a ton in the pro shop. They're looking for a shortcut. But you just don't need the best gear in the world to be good, and you definitely don't need it to get started. In business, too many people obsess over tools, software tricks, scaling issues, fancy office space, lavish furniture, and other frivolities instead of what really matters. And what really matters is how to actually get customers and make money. You also see it in people who want to blog, podcast, or shoot videos for their business, but get hung up on which tools to use. The content is what matters. You can spend tons on fancy equipment, but if you've got nothing to say, well, you've got nothing to say. Use whatever you've got already or can afford cheaply. Then go. It's not the gear that matters. It's playing what you've got as well as you can. Your tone is in your fingers. Sell your byproducts. When you make something, you always make something else. You can't make just one thing. Everything has a byproduct. Observant and creative business minds spot these byproducts and see opportunities. The lumber industry sells what used to be waste, sawdust, chips, and shredded wood, for a pretty profit. You'll find these byproducts in synthetic fireplace logs, concrete, ice strengtheners, mulch, particle board, fuel, and more. But you're probably not manufacturing anything, and that can make it tough to spot your byproducts. People at a lumber company see their waste. They can't ignore sawdust, but you don't see yours. Maybe you don't even think you produce any byproducts, but that's myopic. Our last book, Getting Real, was a byproduct. We wrote that book without even knowing it. The experience that came from building a company and building software was the waste from actually doing the work. We swept up that knowledge first into blog posts, then into a workshop series, then into a PDF, and then into a paperback. That byproduct has made 37 Signals more than $1 million directly and probably more than another $1 million indirectly. The book you're reading right now is a byproduct, too. The rock band Wilco found a valuable byproduct in its recording process. The band filmed the creation of an album and released it as a documentary called I Am Trying to Break Your Heart. It offered an uncensored and fascinating look at the group's creative process and infighting. The band made money off the movie and also used it as a stepping stone toward reaching a wider audience. Henry Ford learned of a process for turning wood scraps from the production of Model Ts into charcoal briquettes. He built a charcoal plant and Ford Charcoal was created, later renamed Kingsford Charcoal. Today, Kingsford is still the leading manufacturer of charcoal in America. Software companies don't usually think about writing books. Bands don't usually think about filming the recording process. Car manufacturers don't usually think about selling charcoal. There's probably something you haven't thought about that you could sell too. Launch now. When is your product or service finished? When should you put it out on the market? When is it safe to let people have it? Probably a lot sooner than you're comfortable with. Once your product does what it needs to do, get it out there. Just because you've still got a list of things to do doesn't mean it's not done. Don't hold everything else up because of a few leftovers. You can do them later. And doing them later may mean doing them better, too. Think about it this way. If you had to launch your business in 2 weeks, what would you cut out? Funny how a question like that forces you to focus. You suddenly realize there's a lot of stuff you don't need, and what you do need seems obvious. When you impose a deadline, you gain clarity. It's the best way to get to that gut instinct that tells you, we don't need this. Put off anything you don't need for launch. Build the necessities now. Worry about the luxuries later. If you really think about it, there's a whole lot you don't need on day one. When we launched Basecamp, we didn't even have the ability to bill customers. Because the product billed in monthly cycles, we knew we had a 30-day gap to figure it out. So we used the time before launch to solve more urgent problems that actually mattered on day one. Day 30 could wait. Camper, a brand of shoes, opened a store in San Francisco before construction was even finished and called it a walk in progress. Customers could draw on the walls of the empty store. Camper displayed shoes on cheap plywood laid over dozens of shoeboxes. The most popular message written by customers on the walls, keep the store just the way it is. Likewise, the founders of Crate and Barrel didn't wait to build fancy displays when they opened their first store. They turned over the crates and barrels that the merchandise came in and stacked products on top of them. Don't mistake this approach for skimping on quality either. You still want to make something great. This approach just recognizes that the best way to get there is through iterations. Stop imagining what's going to work. Find out for real. Productivity. Illusions of agreement. The business world is littered with dead documents that do nothing but waste people's time. Reports no one reads, diagrams no one looks at, and specs that never resemble the finished product. These things take forever to make, but only seconds to forget. If you need to explain something, try getting real with it. Instead of describing what something looks like, draw it. Instead of explaining what something sounds like, hum it. Do everything you can to remove layers of abstraction. The problem with abstractions, like reports and documents, is that they create illusions of agreement. 100 people can read the same words, but in their heads, they're imagining 100 different things. That's why you want to get to something real right away. That's when you get true understanding. It's like when we read about characters in a book. We each picture them differently in our heads, but when we actually see people, we all know exactly what they look like. When the team at Alaska Airlines wanted to build a new airport of the future, they didn't rely on blueprints and sketches. They got a warehouse and built mock-ups using cardboard boxes for podiums, kiosks, and belts. The team then built a small prototype in Anchorage to test systems with real passengers and employees. The design that resulted from this getting real process has significantly reduced wait times and increased agent productivity. Widely admired furniture craftsman Sam Maloof felt it was impossible to make a working drawing to show all the intricate and fine details that go into a chair or stool. "Many times I do not know how a certain area is to be done until I start working with a chisel, rasp, or whatever tool is needed for that particular job," he said. That's the path we all should take. Get the chisel out and start making something real. Anything else is just a distraction. Reasons to quit. It's easy to put your head down and just work on what you think needs to be done. It's a lot harder to pull your head up and ask why. Here are some important questions to ask yourself to ensure you're doing work that matters. Why are you doing this? Ever find yourself working on something without knowing exactly why? Someone just told you to do it. It's pretty common, actually. That's why it's important to ask why you're working on blank. What is this for? Who benefits? What's the motivation behind it? Knowing the answers to these questions will help you better understand the work itself. What problem are you solving? What's the problem? Are customers confused? Are you confused? Is something not clear enough? Was something not possible before that should be possible now? Sometimes when you ask these questions, you'll find you're solving an imaginary problem. That's when it's time to stop and reevaluate what the hell you're doing. Is this actually useful? Are you making something useful or just making something? It's easy to confuse enthusiasm with usefulness. Sometimes it's fine to play a bit and build something cool, but eventually you've got to stop and ask yourself if it's useful too. Cool wears off. Useful never does. Are you adding value? Adding something is easy. Adding value is hard. Is this thing you're working on actually making your product more valuable for customers? Can they get more out of it than they did before? Sometimes things you think are adding value actually subtract from it. Too much ketchup can ruin the fries. Value is about balance. Will this change behavior? Is what you're working on really going to change anything? Don't add something unless it has a real impact on how people use your product. Is there an easier way? Whenever you're working on something, ask, "Is there an easier way?" You'll often find this easy way is more than good enough for now. Problems are usually pretty simple. We just imagine that they require hard solutions. What could you be doing instead? What can't you do because you're doing this? This is especially important for small teams with constrained resources. That's when prioritization is even more important. If you work on A, can you still do B and C before April? If not, would you rather have B and C instead of A? If you're stuck on something for a long period of time, that means there are other things you're not getting done. Is it really worth it? Is what you're doing really worth it? Is this meeting worth pulling 6 people off their work for an hour? Is it worth pulling an all-nighter tonight, or could you just finish it up tomorrow? Is it worth getting all stressed out over a press release from a competitor? Is it worth spending your money on advertising? Determine the real value of what you're about to do before taking the plunge. Keep asking yourself and others the questions listed above. You don't need to make it a formal process, but don't let it slide either. Also, don't be timid about your conclusions. Sometimes abandoning what you're working on is the right move, even if you've already put in a lot of effort. Don't throw good time after bad work. Interruption is the enemy of productivity. If you're constantly staying late and working weekends, it's not because there's too much work to be done. It's because you're not getting enough done at work. And the reason is interruptions. Think about it. When do you get most of your work done? If you're like most people, it's at night or early in the morning. It's no coincidence that these are the times when nobody else is around. At 2 p.m., people are usually in a meeting or answering email or chatting with colleagues. Those taps on the shoulder and little impromptu get-togethers may seem harmless, but they're actually corrosive to productivity. Interruption is not collaboration, it's just interruption. And when you're interrupted, you're not getting work done. Interruptions break your workday into a series of work moments. 45 minutes and then you have a call. 15 minutes and then you have lunch. An hour later, you have an afternoon meeting. Before you know it, it's 5 o'clock and you've only had a couple uninterrupted hours to get your work done. You can't get meaningful things done when you're constantly going start, stop, start, stop. Instead, you should get in the alone zone. Long stretches of alone time are when you're most productive. When you don't have to mind shift between various tasks, you get a boatload done. Ever notice how much work you get done on a plane since you're offline and there are zero outside distractions? Getting into that zone takes time and requires avoiding interruptions. It's like REM sleep. You don't just go directly into REM sleep. You go to sleep first and then make your way to REM. Any interruptions force you to start over. And just as REM is when the real sleep magic happens, the alone zone is where the real productivity magic happens. Your alone zone doesn't have to be in the wee hours, though. You can set up a rule at work that half the day is set aside for alone time. Decree that from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m., people can't talk to each other except during lunch. Or make the first or last half of the day your alone time period. Or instead of casual Fridays, try no-talk Thursdays. Just make sure this period is unbroken in order to avoid productivity-zapping interruptions. And go all the way with it. A successful alone time period means letting go of communication addiction. During alone time, give up instant messages, phone calls, email, and meetings. Just shut up and get to work. You'll be surprised how much more you get done. Also, when you do collaborate, try to use passive communication tools like email that don't require an instant reply instead of interruptive ones like phone calls and face-to-face meetings. That way people can respond when it's convenient for them instead of being forced to drop everything right away. Your day is under siege by interruptions. It's on you to fight back. Meetings are toxic. The worst interruptions of all are meetings. Here's why. They're usually about words and abstract concepts, not real things. They usually convey an abysmally small amount of information per minute. They drift off subject easier than a Chicago cab in a snowstorm. They require thorough preparation that most people don't have time for. They frequently have agendas so vague that nobody is really sure of the goal. They often include at least one moron who inevitably gets his turn to waste everyone's time with nonsense. Meetings procreate. One meeting leads to another meeting leads to another. It's also unfortunate that meetings are typically scheduled like TV shows. You set aside 30 minutes or an hour because that's how scheduling software works. You'll never see anyone schedule a 7-minute meeting with Outlook. Too bad. If it only takes 7 minutes to accomplish a meeting's goal, then that's all the time you should spend. Don't stretch 7 into 30. When you think about it, the true cost of meetings is staggering. Let's say you're going to schedule a meeting that lasts 1 hour, and you invite 10 people to attend. That's actually a 10-hour meeting, not a 1-hour meeting. You're trading 10 hours of productivity for 1 hour of meeting time. And it's probably more like 15 hours, because there are mental switching costs that come with stopping what you're doing, going somewhere else to meet, and then resuming what you were doing beforehand. Is it ever okay to trade 10 or 15 hours of productivity for 1 hour of meeting? Sometimes, maybe, but that's a pretty hefty price to pay. Judged on a pure cost basis, meetings of this size quickly become liabilities, not assets. Think about the time you're actually losing and ask yourself if it's really worth it. If you decide you absolutely must get together, try to make your meeting a productive one by sticking to these simple rules. Set a timer. When it rings, meeting's over, period. Invite as few people as possible. Always have a clear agenda. Begin with a specific problem. Meet at the site of the problem instead of a conference room. Point to real things and suggest real changes. End with a solution and make someone responsible for implementing it. Good enough is fine. A lot of people get off on solving problems with complicated solutions. Flexing your intellectual muscles can be intoxicating. Then you start looking for another big challenge that gives you that same rush, regardless of whether it's a good idea or not. A better idea? Find a judo solution, one that delivers maximum efficiency with minimum effort. Judo solutions are all about getting the most out of doing the least. Whenever you face an obstacle, look for a way to judo it. Part of this is recognizing that problems are negotiable. Let's say your challenge is to get a bird's-eye view. One way to do it is to climb Mount Everest. That's the ambitious solution. But then again, you could take an elevator to the top of a tall building. That's a judo solution. Problems can usually be solved with simple, mundane solutions. That means there's no glamorous work. You don't get to show off your amazing skills. You just build something that gets the job done and then move on. This approach may not earn you oohs and ahs, but it lets you get on with it. Look at political campaign ads. A big issue pops up, and politicians have an ad about it on the air the next day. The production quality is low. They use photos instead of live footage. They have static, plain text headlines instead of fancy animated graphics. The only audio is a voiceover done by an unseen narrator. Despite all that, the ad is still good enough. If they waited weeks to perfect it, it would come out too late. It's a situation where timeliness is more important than polish or even quality. When good enough gets the job done, go for it. It's way better than wasting resources or, even worse, doing nothing because you can't afford the complex solution. And remember, you can usually turn good enough into great later. Quick wins. Momentum fuels motivation. It keeps you going. It drives you. Without it, you can't go anywhere. If you aren't motivated by what you're working on, it won't be very good. The way you build momentum is by getting something done and then moving on to the next thing. No one likes to be stuck on an endless project with no finish line in sight. Being in the trenches for 9 months and not having anything to show for it is a real buzzkill. Eventually, it just burns you out. To keep your momentum and motivation up, get in the habit of accomplishing small victories along the way. Even a tiny improvement can give you a good jolt of momentum. The longer something takes, the less likely it is that you're going to finish it. Excitement comes from doing something and then letting customers have at it. Planning a menu for a year is boring. Getting the new menu out, serving the food, and getting feedback is exciting. So don't wait too long. You'll smother your sparks if you do. If you absolutely have to work on long-term projects, try to dedicate one day a week, or every 2 weeks, to small victories that generate enthusiasm. Small victories let you celebrate and release good news. And you want a steady stream of good news. When there's something new to announce every 2 weeks, you energize your team and give your customers something to be excited about. So ask yourself, what can we do in 2 weeks? And then do it. get it out there and let people use it, taste it, play it, or whatever. The quicker it's in the hands of customers, the better off you'll be. Don't be a hero. A lot of times, it's better to be a quitter than a hero. For example, let's say you think a task can be done in 2 hours, but 4 hours into it, you're still only a quarter of the way done. The natural instinct is to think, but I can't give up now. I've already spent 4 hours on this. So you go into hero mode. You're determined to make it work, and slightly embarrassed that it isn't already working. You grab your cape and shut yourself off from the world. And sometimes that kind of sheer effort overload works. But is it worth it? Probably not. The task was worth it when you thought it would cost 2 hours, not 16. In those 16 hours, you could have gotten a bunch of other things done. Plus, you cut yourself off from feedback, which can lead you even further down the wrong path. Even heroes need a fresh pair of eyes sometimes, someone else to give them a reality check. We've experienced this problem firsthand. So we decided that if anything takes one of us longer than 2 weeks, we've got to bring other people in to take a look. They might not do any work on the task, but at least they can review it quickly and give their 2 cents. Sometimes an obvious solution is staring you right in the face, but you can't even see it. Keep in mind that the obvious solution might very well be quitting. People automatically associate quitting with failure, but sometimes that's exactly what you should do. If you already spent too much time on something that wasn't worth it, walk away. You can't get that time back. The worst thing you can do now is waste even more time. Go to sleep. Foregoing sleep is a bad idea. Sure, you get those extra hours right now, but you pay in spades later. You destroy your creativity, morale, and attitude. Once in a while, you can pull an all-nighter if you fully understand the consequences. Just don't make it a habit. If it becomes a constant, the costs start to mount. Stubbornness. When you're really tired, it always seems easier to plow down whatever bad path you happen to be on instead of reconsidering the route. The finish line is a constant mirage, and you wind up walking in the desert way too long. Lack of creativity. Creativity is one of the first things to go when you lose sleep. What distinguishes people who are 10 times more effective than the norm is not that they work 10 times as hard. It's that they use their creativity to come up with solutions that require 1/10 of the effort. Without sleep, you stop coming up with those 1/10 solutions. Diminished morale. When your brain isn't firing on all cylinders, it loves to feed on less demanding tasks, like reading yet another article about stuff that doesn't matter. When you're tired, you lose motivation to attack the big problems. Irritability. Your ability to remain patient and tolerant is severely reduced when you're tired. If you encounter someone who's acting like a fool, there's a good chance that person is suffering from sleep deprivation. These are just some of the costs you incur when not getting enough sleep. Yet some people still develop a masochistic sense of honor about sleep deprivation. They even brag about how tired they are. Don't be impressed. It'll come back to bite them in the ass. Your estimates suck. We're all terrible estimators. We think we can guess how long something will take, when we really have no idea. We see everything going according to a best-case scenario, without the delays that inevitably pop up. Reality never sticks to best-case scenarios. That's why estimates that stretch weeks, months, and years into the future are fantasies. The truth is, you just don't know what's going to happen that far in advance. How often do you think a quick trip to the grocery store will take only a few minutes, and then it winds up taking an hour? And remember when cleaning out the attic took you all day instead of just the couple of hours you thought it would? Or sometimes it's the opposite, like that time you planned on spending 4 hours raking the yard only to have it take just 35 minutes. We humans are just plain bad at estimating. Even with these simple tasks, our estimates are often off by a factor of 2 or more. If we can't be accurate when estimating a few hours, how can we expect to accurately predict the length of a 6-month project? Plus, we're not just a little bit wrong when we guess how long something will take, we're a lot wrong. That means if you're guessing 6 months, you might be way off. We're not talking 7 months instead of 6, we're talking 1 year instead of 6 months. That's why Boston's Big Dig Highway project finished 5 years late and billions over budget. Or the Denver International Airport opened 16 months late at a cost overrun of $2 billion. The solution? Break the big thing into smaller things. The smaller it is, the easier it is to estimate. You're probably still going to get it wrong, but you'll be a lot less wrong than if you estimated a big project. If something takes twice as long as you expected, better to have it be a small project that's a couple weeks over rather than a long one that's a couple months over. Keep breaking your time frames down into smaller chunks. Instead of one 12-week project, structure it as 12 one-week projects. Instead of guesstimating at tasks that take 30 hours or more, break them down into more realistic 6 to 10-hour chunks. Then go one step at a time. Long lists don't get done. Start making smaller to-do lists, too. Long lists collect dust. When's the last time you finished a long list of things? You might have knocked off the first few, but chances are you eventually abandoned it, or blindly checked off items that weren't really done properly. Long lists are guilt trips. The longer the list of unfinished items, the worse you feel about it. And at a certain point, you just stop looking at it because it makes you feel bad. Then you stress out, and the whole thing turns into a big mess. There's a better way. Break that long list down into a bunch of smaller lists. For example, break a single list of 100 items into 10 lists of 10 items. That means when you finish an item on a list, you've completed 10% of that list instead of 1%. Yes, you still have the same amount of stuff left to do. But now you can look at the small picture and find satisfaction, motivation, and progress. That's a lot better than staring at the huge picture and being terrified and demoralized. Whenever you can, divide problems into smaller and smaller pieces until you're able to deal with them completely.